My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. Are nightmares there just to frighten us, or are they capable of bringing awareness to events in our waking life that require our attention? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Kelly Sullivan Walden, also known as Dr. Dream, says nightmares are the unsung heroes of our subconscious. Kelly Sullivan Walden is an award-winning, best-selling author of 10 books, a dream expert, certified clinical hypnotherapist, inspirational speaker, workshop facilitator, and she holds a doctoral degree in interfaith studies. Her unique approach to dream work led her to consult thousands of individuals, from Fortune 500 executives to celebrities to stay-at-home moms. She hosts the Kelly Sullivan Walden Show podcast and is the founder of Dreamwork Practitioner Training, an online professional development program empowering people to incorporate dream work into their careers. Her website is KellySullivanWalden.com, and she returns to Destination Unlimited this week to share her latest book, A Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste. Please join me in welcoming back to Destination Unlimited, Kelly Sullivan Walden. Welcome back, Kelly.
Thank you for having me, Victor. It's such a wonderful treat to be with you.
Kelly, it's been 2 years since your last appearance on Destination Unlimited and almost 7 years since your first. Congratulations on being a charter member of the Destination Unlimited Platinum Lounge.
Yay! Cue the applause. I'm so excited. I need a star on my forehead and I need a parade. Actually, that's what I need.
There you go. Yeah. For our listeners meeting you for the first time, please share your early path and how it led to you becoming Dr. Dream.
Oh, well, I've always been interested in dreams since I was very little, which is, I think most people would say when they were little, they paid attention to dreams. I had a partner in shine or crime, as the case may be, who my younger sister, there's five girls in my family, and my sister Shannon is the one closest in age to me. And we paid attention to dreams. We were in similar dreamscapes. Technically known as tandem dreaming, but we just thought it was cool. And so I was particularly enamored of dreams. And this led me all the way through my growing up years and all the way into my early adulthood. But when my eyes turned toward all the blinging lights of Hollywood and the external world, I kind of stopped paying as much attention to the inner world of my soul and of my dreams. And which some of us do this, we get more excited about the people, places, and things outside of ourselves and stop paying as much attention to that still small voice. And that was true for me. And I hit a crisis point where I became so empty and I couldn't hear that voice anymore. I had stopped paying attention to it. It's as if it went away. And I became suicidal, actually. It was a very, very dark night of the soul. And I, instead of not being here on the planet, I decided if I'm going to be here, I need to give it a shot. And so I dove headfirst into therapy, into all spiritual modalities, 12-step programs, shamanism, crystal, hypnotherapy. And I became a certified clinical hypnotherapist. And that was about 25 years ago. And that was a really important time for me because the subconscious mind is what hypnotherapy is the field of. And the subconscious mind is also where dreams take place. Dreams are the language of the subconscious mind. So my dreams came back to me. And they came back, though, with fangs, I like to say, because I had ignored them. It was as if they were pissed and they were unruly. They were terrifying. I had a lot of chasing dreams. But I was just grateful that I had them back. I had a therapist, a hypnotherapist at the time, who said that she was talking to me about my nightmares. And she said, a nightmare, Kelly, is an unfinished dream. And you have the power as the director of your dreams to change that dream and to give it the ending that would empower you. And that would change my life. That phrase, that moment in time was so liberating, because I decided that I could change my dream, and I started to change. I worked on one nightmare in particular and altered it. And I noticed that it had a direct effect on my well-being and my sense of confidence in my waking dream. And then I started to teach this to my clients. And I started to, almost as if to want to cut out the middleman and just go right to the source, I would tell my clients to just tell me their dreams, because I wanted there to be progress. I wanted to make good use of their time. And I figured by starting with a dream, we would get right to it, as opposed to kind of dancing around the periphery. So this went on for years, and I was encouraged by clients and friends that I needed to write a book on dreams, because people were appreciating my point of view on dreams. And basically they were saying that my point of view about dreams was empowering. They didn't feel crazy when I would reflect what I thought their dreams were telling them. And they had assumed that their dreams were telling them that there was something wrong with them. And I saw that there was gold in them, their hills. And that became my point of view. So I did write a book, and it became published through Warner Books at the time. And then that kind of translated down the pike to Hachette Books and Grand Central Publishing. And it sold really well. And I started to then write my next book and my next and my next. And I've written 10 books now, not quite as many as your wife, Lori Sue Brockway, but I'm getting there. But my life has been very, very dream centric since then. And that, I've become known as Dr. Dream as a result of my absolute obsession and fascination and passion about
the
dreams.
Last time you were on, you referred to yourself as the love child of Carl Jung and Lucille Ball. Please explain.
Well, I've been told that, you know, I've got very, very distinct aspects of my personality, Victor. When I'm in this mode, radio mode, I'm in my Dr. Dream mode for the most part, except when I'm with you, I feel safe and free to let everyone come out to play. So all the sub-personalities, not split personalities, that's a different distinction. But I've got a part of me that is very serious. And we could even say it kind of goes back to my English ancestry. But then I've got the other half of me is Irish and a little crazy and irreverent and loves a good joke. And so I think the Carl Jung part of me is the serious doctoral aspect. And then the goofball part would be Lucille Ball. So what would happen if they came together and had a love child? Maybe I would be the granddaughter. Let's put it that way. Not the daughter.
Absolutely. Something very special also occurred after our last interview. You earned a doctorate in interfaith studies from my spiritual alma mater, the New Seminary. Congratulations.
Thank you, Victor. Oh, my goodness. Talk about being a lighthouse and knowing that you make a difference on the planet. You inspired me. We did that interview during COVID, and you shared with me, I think it was when we were done with our interview. I don't know if it was during the interview or after, but when you talked about how you used the time during COVID, during lockdown, to do some of the things that you'd always wanted to do, including going back and completing your doctorate degree, I thought, oh, I've always wanted to do that too. People have been calling me Dr. Dream since my first dream book came out. And I've always felt a little bit like I was misrepresenting myself. I would always have to put those quotation marks in front of Dr. Dream when using that in my bio. But I thought, maybe I could do that. Hey, if Victor could do it, maybe I could do it too. So you paved the royal road for me. And then I went to the new seminary and I've got my degree, my doctoral degree in interfaith studies as well, thanks to you. And I give a big shout out to the new seminary and Dr. Jay Spates and Samora Jones. What a wonderful, and Stacy Goforth and all the wonderful folks there. I absolutely love it. And if anybody's listening and they're like, maybe I should do that, I highly recommend it.
Absolutely. You have written so many wonderful books on dreams and what they mean in our lives, including your best-selling dream dictionaries. Tell our listeners about I Had the Strangest Dream.
I Had the Strangest Dream. That was my first dream book. I had written a couple books before that, but this was my first dream book. And I Had the Strangest Dream is a dictionary of sorts. And I know people that are very, very adamant dream folks. They say, you're not supposed to write a dream dictionary. You can't tell anyone definitively what their dream means. But my perspective was so many people want to throw their dreams away because they don't make sense to them, because dreams speak in a very different symbolic language than the ordinary language we use in our waking mind. And I thought, well, as a step before people are willing to toss out the gold that's in their dreams, they should at least have a good dictionary to be able to run the primary symbols of their dreams by, so that they could have this perspective and maybe discover the gold themselves. So my perspective on these dream symbols, it's over 1,000 modern dream symbols, 21st century dream symbols decoded. And they have a decidedly, they're encoded not just in a typical way, but with my perspective that does see life and dreams in a life affirming way. So even symbols like fire, which some dream dictionaries would say simply represent destruction or the forecasting that something terrible is about to happen. My perspective is fire represents radical change, not just incremental change, but radical change. And if one structure is burning down in your life, that means simultaneously, just as in nature, when there's a fire, like the jack pine, those kernels will only actually open up and grow because of fire. So maybe there's some latent aspects of yourself that need that heat in order for you to passionately feel them in order to grow. So there's a kind of a positive spin on even the very dark symbols in our dreams.
When I was a kid in the early 1960s, I used to have a dream that the planet Saturn was chasing me down the street. What do you think that meant?
The planet Saturn was chasing you down the street. Wow, that is so powerful. Well, if I would ask you first, I definitely start to get my own percolations, but I always want to invite the dreamer to tell me a little bit about what some of the symbols mean to them. So if I was an alien, well, I would probably know what Saturn was if I was an alien. But from, give me in a few words, what does Saturn mean to you?
Well, at the time, I did have a lot of what I would call UFO or ET experiences. So this obviously was a reflection of that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, the very first thing that comes to me, if it were my dream, is whenever anything is chasing us, I believe that it is a very important aspect of ourselves that has perhaps been in the shadow, been something that we've relegated to, well, this couldn't possibly be a part of me. I want to just be an ordinary guy. It's kind of maybe the reluctant messiah complex, where it's like, okay, Saturn is chasing me because it wants me to connect with it. It wants me to understand it. It wants to give me a message. It wants to love me, share with me, connect with me. But if I'm the dreamer and I'm running from it, it's some part of me that may be running at least just temporarily from my calling, from being able to embrace a more universal, cosmic, universal perspective, rather than just the mundane world. So we can run, but we can't hide from our true calling. And sometimes we do run from it first, just as in the hero's journey. The one of the very first things that happens in the hero's journey is we get the call to adventure. Yay. And then the next thing we do is we promptly refuse it and run from it, like Jonah and the whale. So it feels like this is the part of, I'd say, Saturn with all its rings would represent in many ways the calling that you've now come to embrace and accept. But maybe there was a little bit of, wow, this is too big. I'm just a little guy. I'm just me. I'm just a guy from the Midwest. What are you doing?
My 10-year-old self, I'm sure, was not ready to embrace what I'm doing in my life.
Right.
A decade. So, yeah.
Yeah, but preparing you in some way. I mean, just like for me, the shadowy dreams that were chasing me. I mean, I had shadows. I had really difficult creatures that have become my allies now, because a lot of the work I do is about helping people to embrace their shadow. So I had to embrace mine. And I mean, often what is chasing us, if we work with it, becomes central to our calling and to what we do, that becomes part of our gift to life. So I'd say Saturn and its many rings, we could say, is symbolic of what you've come to do and embrace and offer this world. Would you say?
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. Is there any really wild dream that someone shared with you that was totally off the wall?
Oh God, every day, every single day. Let me see. Gosh, what can I, I'm going to give you just one that this one's popping into my head, but it's not, I don't know if this is the wildest, but, and this one's from my husband. I've got a lot from my clients that I could share. My husband was talking about, in his dream, he was walking near the ocean. He was climbing up all these kind of rocks and boulders, and then he finds himself staring at this giant eye, and it's this beautiful giant eye that is 10 times bigger than he is. And he gasps, he's in awe, in the true meaning of awe, which is like fear and amazement. And he backs up and he realizes as he's been climbing all over a beached whale, and the eye was the eye of the whale. And that eye of the whale has, so that's been with him. And only when we talked about when we decoded that dream later, we realized that the word play is I am that whale. The any kind of I in a dream is kind of symbolic of that is I. So he's working with, now these days, years later, he's working on a film called The Whale Dreamer with a friend of ours who has also had a tremendous number of whale dreams. And it turns out whale dreams are a phenomenon that a lot of people are having, that really connecting people with Sirius and with a whole other dimension of reality is quite profound and beautiful. So I'd say that's one. I don't know if that's the craziest one. I could probably dig a little deeper.
That's actually a wonderful dream. Thank you for sharing that with us. That was beautiful. Mm. Last time you joined us, we discussed your book, Luminous Humanus. How may we express our luminous humanosity?
Oh, thank you, Victor. I love that you always take me on a bit of a walk down memory lane, and it's wonderful. So this is, my last book was Luminous Humanness, and that was a book that had been in the making for so long. It came to me as I was on a hike during kind of a rough patch in my life, and I was, as I do sometimes, I don't know that I'm proud of this, but sometimes I yell at God. I'm not just praying to God like, oh God, how sweet thou art. Sometimes I'm like, God, what's going on? Like, come on, really? Why did this happen? And on this particular rant, I was saying, why do I always have to elevate to you? I was being just a little brat. So why don't you, if you're almighty, why don't you come to me? Just come to me. And in that moment on my walk, I stopped in my tracks as a buck ran across my path with its massive, massive antlers. And had I kept walking, I would have been trampled by it. And there was something in that moment that jarred me. And I don't know why these words just flew out of my mouth. It was luminous humanness. I felt like there was something about how the divine, the luminousness of the universe came into my humanness. As opposed to always climbing that stairway to heaven, I felt like the luminous energy of the divine came into my body. And there was this crossing of this buck with these antlers. And I have always been a fan of Patricia Garfield's, who wrote a book, one of the first big landmark books about dreams called Creative Dreaming. And her big dream that started her on her path was about her seeing this woman with kind of antlers on her head. So there was something very symbolic about these antlers that came charging across my path. It got my attention. And there were so many synchronicities that came up around this notion of luminous humanness. And I started to compile if I was going to write a book that was able to anchor this consciousness, because I didn't want to just have a fleeting moment of this awe-inspired energy. I wanted it to last. And I thought I would, once upon a time, I read a book called Simple Abundance. And it was a message for every day of the year by Sarah Ban Breathnach. And I thought, I want to write a book that's got a message for every day of the year. So that's what I decided to do with Luminous Humanness. There's a passage for every single day, 365 days. So we can pick up the page every day and have this little jolt of remembering who we are. So it blends a bit of a dream consciousness, but it's much more of it's kind of bringing the spirituality into our bodies. It's very much about embodying that consciousness on a daily basis.
And the fact that we're luminous has been proven by science, who in 2010 were actually able to take images of photons emanating from the human body.
Ooh, Victor.
Luminous humanness. Wonderful. Absolutely.
Well, if I ever get to write the part, the 2.0 version of that book, I'm going to include you and that quote in the book.
My guest, Reverend Dr. Kelly Sullivan Walden, her new book, A Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste. We'll be talking about that in the next segment. Kelly, please tell our listeners where they can get your books and find out more about you and your wonderful work.
Thank you so much. My books are available wherever books are sold. I highly recommend that people go to their local bookstores. And if you've got a Barnes & Noble nearby, go there. And if it's convenient, then go ahead, get it on Amazon or barnesandnoble.com. And Victor, it hit number one. It was the hot new release, number one hot new release when it came out, which is exciting. So it's been a bestseller in four categories on amazon.com. So people can go there. And there's also, I've extended the prizes that people can get if they go to my website, kellysullivanwalden.com. If you sign up there, there's some free dream giveaways that you get from me.
And we'll be back with more of Kelly after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
The best of the holistic, spiritual, and conscious world. OM Times Radio. IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, Kelly Sullivan Walden. Kelly, your new book, published on January 17th and already a number one hit on all the websites, is entitled A Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste, The Art of Transforming the Tragic into Magic. As my 70th birthday was on January 17th, I want to thank you for this lovely gift.
You're welcome, Capricorn. Wow, had I known. That's amazing. Oh, and happy birthday.
Thank you so much. Kelly, wow. What inspired this wonderful new book?
Oh, Lord. I'd say the nutshell of it. Well, there's so many different ways I could get into this, but we could say that there's been a theme in my life around authenticity. And I do so much work, like I said earlier in the earlier segment, on shadow work with clients. And there's something about heal or heal thyself. In my perspective on dreams that are difficult is that they're always operating on behalf of our healing, our health, and our wholeness. They're never just trying to torture us. They're always trying to give us a gift if we look deeply at them. And I eventually, if you do this work long enough where you look at those shadowy dreams from that perspective, you start to kind of look at your waking life from that perspective as well. So I started to notice that in my private sessions with clients and with my friends, they would benefit more from me talking about my stories of like my mud stories, my stories of how I struggled and then how I had an epiphany and then how I made it to the mountaintop, as opposed to just sharing about how I just arrived at the mountaintop on birth and started, you know, just having wisdom. I decided to start writing about this. Also, one of the opening stories in my book is actually where I was being interviewed by a local newspaper, which felt like a big deal because they came to my house. It was one of the only in-person written interviews I had ever done. And in the middle of the interview, she was asking me about dreams. And then she asked if there was anything off limits. I said, nope, I'm an open book, ask away. And she said, okay, so you relate to nightmares in this really positive way, but do you relate to waking life in that same way? And I said, yeah. And she said, so that's how you relate to your past as a stripper. And I said, what? And I all of a sudden wanted to faint, wanted to throw up, wanted to, I realized that I hadn't embraced this 1 year of my life. It had been kind of the darkest year of my life, and I had not fully embraced it. It had been still in my closet, not fully embraced. And I felt so humiliated that this person was calling me out, and I'm supposed to be this public figure that walks her talk, and I hadn't fully done that. After she left that day, and I just felt like I had mud on my face, I decided if somebody's going to call me out, if somebody's going to tell my story, then I want it to be me. I don't want it to be somebody else who might not tell the story accurately. So it was soon after that day that I really began writing my story and writing the stories that I was the most embarrassed of, that I was the most humiliated by, or that I would be the most humiliated by if people knew. And I noticed that by writing these stories, I discovered that each of these things that happened to me were exactly the university, basically, that I learned the most, the wisdom that I wouldn't trade for anything, that they were part and parcel. They went together. And I began in the process of writing to love these stories. And I started to share them with a few trusted people. And they thought, wow, Kelly, this is really different writing than anything you've ever done, but I really like it. You should, you know, keep writing. And eventually this book became kind of the chronicle of everything in my life that I was so embarrassed and humiliated by. And it starts off with the humiliation, but then it leads to the wisdom. And so it's very different. People have been saying, Kelly, this is different. This is very revealing. And
absolutely. You start out with what you call the nitty-gritty S-wordy list, which is all the things that you were not so proud about or embarrassed or hurt by. Can you care to give us a couple of more examples of those?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, I start off by some of the things on that nitty gritty bleep list are the fact that I've already said when, you know, I had 100+ Me Too moments during my Hollywood days. One of those led to me being a stripper for a year in my early 20s. And then after that, I was in relationships where I was stalked, where I had to file restraining orders. I was up close and personal with the mafia. I was robbed. I had my purse stolen. I don't have the list in front of me, but it goes on and on with, I jumped off a cliff, landed on my bleep, and almost died in that way. I did have a near-death experience. I've lost two of my best, lifelong best friends, and my three dogs, two of my little lap dogs that are on the other side. So I just, all of these things. And then plus a baby, my husband and I were adopting. And then I say at the end of the list, and in the time it's taken me to share all of these awful things, I've had one of the 50 hot flashes I'll have today. And so this is my list. And I invite you to share your nitty gritty bleep list with me as well. And there's something in just kind of getting that off my chest and knowing that I didn't get struck by lightning while that happened, that I can still breathe and I'm still here. It's kind of miraculous, because in my all these years, I thought if anybody knew these things about me, I would be sent off the island. I would be burnt at the stake. I would be gone. I would lose my status in society. And it seems like I think the part of the reason I'm writing this is to let people know that if these things haven't happened to me, then they might not happen to you. So it might be a safer world we live in than we might have thought. And not to say that there aren't places on this planet where people have to cover themselves. Mahsa Amini in Iran, you know, she showed her hair and was murdered. There's some horrible things still happening in this world when people try to express themselves. But for those of us who have the wherewithal to express ourselves, it's a human right to do so. And I believe that the more of that we do, the more we are part of the change that eventually will lead to a world where we can be fully ourselves and fully expressed.
Amen to that. And you also say that your proudest accomplishments exist not despite of, but because of your heartbreaks.
Absolutely. And this is how it is with all of us. If we all just made a list of the things that we like best about ourselves, or that we wouldn't trade for anything, the wisdom, the insights, we could draw a direct line back to the scene of the crime that was the difficult thing we went through, that we learned something brilliant that came from that. And that is exactly the truth for me. I mean, I think one of the stories in my book, I write about being on a service trip to Colombia and promptly having my purse stolen that had all my money, my passport, my laptop, with several partial books written that were not backed up on my laptop. And I had, so no phone, no laptop. I spent an entire month on that trip without any of my devices that I didn't realize had become my vices. And so the blessing in disguise of having those things stolen from me was that I got to experience a month technology free. And as a result of that, years later, I'm one of the only people in my world that can really put my phone down, that can walk away from my laptop for days at a time, or at least hours at a time, where most people are just chained to them these days. And there's a strange piece of wisdom that comes from having our things, our belongings, without them having us. And because I had to endure that, and I wouldn't wish it on myself again, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody else, because it was quite traumatic in so many ways to have to, you know, I won't go into all of those stories. It's all in my book. You can read more about it. But it was a blessing in presence as well. I didn't realize how unpresent I had been, because the devices had been like the smoke and mirrors, clouding me from being able to be really heart to heart, soul to soul with people in my life. So things like that, I wouldn't trade any of the things I went through for anything. I'm grateful for them.
And you preface "a crisis is a terrible thing to waste" with the acronym OGLE. The word OGLE is defined as staring lecherously, but your acronym means something very different and empowers us to deal with a crisis. Please explain the OGLE method.
Yeah, I think it is a very strange word, but I have to give some credit to Rasuli. He's the amazing fusion artist that has done the artwork for my Hero's Journey Dream Oracle decks and so many of my other Oracle decks. And one day I was complimenting him on being a great artist. He said, "I am not an artist. I am an ogler." And I said, "What? Why would you say that? What?" And he said, "I notice the things that everyone else misses, and I get off on the details. I am turned on by the things that most people don't see. And I thought, oh, wow, I want to be an ogler, but I'm not an artist in that way. I'm not a visual artist, but I'd like to be an ogler of the transformational variety, somebody who really sees what's going on in life and doesn't just get caught up in what's on the surface. So I began to think about that for a couple of years. And then I started to notice, one day I was actually in the middle of, I was on my way to have what would be a very difficult confrontation with a person that I love very much who I'd been having a rough time with. And as I was driving up the mountain road to go see her, I thought, I need to arm myself with all the tools I have, but I need them with me in an accessible way. And I started to amalgamize and crystallize the like tens of thousands of tools that I have in my toolbox. And somehow on that drive, it sorted itself as O-G-L-E. It's important to notice, what is offensive, and to give voice to the pain of what hurts, what is difficult, and to not sugarcoat the pain and the difficulty when it shows up. So that's the O. And then the G is, it's important to, once you're done like saying O, is to go in and look for what's good about that painful thing. What might be good? What could, even on a parallel plane in the rings of Saturn, what might be good about this? And then once you look for the gold, the good in what that difficult thing is, then we turn it around and go into the looking glass. How is this an aspect of me? And Victor, you've heard me talk about this in dream work. We're taught by the late great Carl Jung that everyone and everything in our dream is an aspect of ourselves. And when we can do that in our waking life, and we can look at that difficult circumstance or difficult person in our life as an aspect of ourselves, we immediately, as difficult of a bitter pill as that is to swallow, we step out of victimhood. We step into being victorious in that moment, because we see that we're in the looking glass, and that we can the E in Ogle is about elevating our perspective, taking an elevated step, that we're now empowered to do something positive with that. So O-G-L-E is what's offensive. Give ourselves permission to moan and groan and about it. G is what is good about this, what might be good or what could be good about this circumstance. And then the L is the looking glass. How is this me? How did I steal, not just steal my purse, but how have I stolen my own time from myself? How have I stolen precious moments of presence from myself? How am I the thief, even if it's just a speck? And then the E is, how will I elevate that circumstance? And in my case, with regards to that theft, how will I stop stealing precious moments from my precious time that I have with my loved ones? I'm going to give them more presence. And that became my leveled up behavior. So that's Ogle, Victor.
And you share many, many examples of the Ogle method. Is there another one you can share with us for our listeners?
Sure, of course. Let me think. Well, here's one. When this makes it sound like I'm always traveling. I like to travel, but in this one, that's the first story I opened the book with. It's my husband and I were traveling in Italy. We were in Milan. We were going to be flying home the next day, and my husband had been filming a project. So we had tons of equipment, tons of stuff. And we were on the train heading toward, it was the last train of the day. I didn't realize this. And I misunderstood the instructions over the loudspeaker, and we missed our stop. And I thought, well, this is no big deal. We'll get off at the next stop and we'll be able to just take another train going the opposite way. Meanwhile, there was this, everyone on the train was friendly, except for this one guy who reminded me immediately of the cartoon, the Pixar show, Despicable Me. There's a character named Gru, and he's got dark circles under his eyes, a long pointy snout, and this sort of hunched shoulders. And he looks like the quintessential villain. And I noticed this guy leering, talk about ogling. He was like ogling. me. And so I just made sure to not look at him. Anyway, we get off on the, we miss our stop, and we get off on the stop afterwards. And I thought, no big deal, Dana, we're going to be fine. We'll just take the train coming back. But as soon as we get on the train platform with our mountain of luggage, all the lights go out on in the little depot on the station. We realized everything had shut down. There was no train coming in the opposite direction until the next morning. So we were stranded, and there was no cell service to be able to call for an Uber where we were. And so we were not light on our feet. We were not nimble, and we were sitting there and trying to figure out where we should go and what we should do. And little, and all of a sudden I noticed footsteps coming toward us in the dark. And lo and behold, it's Gru from Despicable Me. It's the guy from the train. And my body goes cold. I think, oh my God, we're gonna die. This guy's gonna, I mean, he's gonna kill us or rape me or us or whatever. Something bad's gonna happen. And he asks in Italian, kind of, and I say, I don't speak Italian, but I speak Spanish, and he speaks a little Spanish. So he asked if we needed a ride, and Dana said no. and I said yes, because I said, and I whispered to Dana, we're either going to die by sitting here waiting for someone else to come along, or we're going to die at the hands of somebody we now know. So I say, this is the lesser of the evils. Let's go with him. And so we're reticent. We're following him. He picks up the heaviest part of the equipment because he's very strong. And we walk to his hearse. So not only is it not a regular, it's a hearse. He's a hearse driver. So he loads our luggage into the back of his empty hearse. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, what? And then, so we're in the car, we're in the hearse, we're driving. And we start getting out into the city where there's suddenly cell reception. So I get my Uber, I mean, not Uber, but I get my GPS to let him know where the hotel is that we're going to. And I say, turn right up here, but he turns left. And then I hear the correction, and he gets mad at me for trying to tell him where to go. And I thought, oh, well, all right, here we go. We're going to die. He's taking us somewhere to kill us. And I remembered some episode of CSI that I had watched years before that said, if a killer knows your name, they might be less apt to kill you because it personalizes you to them. So I say, by the way, I'm Kelly. This is Dana. What's your name? And he says, his name is Fatih. So I say, hi, Fatih. And I'm just praying. And I must have, he must have known where the hotel was. Anyway, eventually, as I'm praying, we eventually end up at our hotel. He must have known a different way to get there. And we're fine. We're intact. And I have this just, my heart just jumps out of my chest. It's so grateful. I start crying. Oh my God, we're alive. We're at our hotel. And oh my God. And I give him a hug and I thank him. And I go to reach in my pocket to give him some money to thank him. And he says, no, like he's mad at me for insinuating that I would give him money. I said, oh my God, he's going to kill me because I offered him money and that was an insult. And I said, well, we got to thank you. We got to thank you. Would you join us for dinner? And his face softened into this beautiful, sweet smile. And he said, yes, see. So Dana and I put our luggage up in our room and we huddle, we cry, we're shaking, we're alive. We made it to our hotel and we go down and we see him sitting at a table waiting for us. And he's just this very pleasant person. And we have this incredible dinner, this great conversation. Everything's going great until the very end. I say something about, because we're communicating via hybrid Spanish, Italian, English. It's kind of a mess. And we're talking, and I say something about how lovely the Italian languages, the Romance languages are so beautiful compared to English. And he hits his fists on the table and he says, no, English is the most beautiful language. It is the language of freedom. How dare you, you spoiled American. You speak this language, it's so easy for you. You don't, and I thought, oh God, now he's really gonna kill me. Oh my God, okay, I'll never do that. I'll never do that again. Anyway, so later when I ogled this in my mind, the O is for what was offensive, was that we got on the train, dumped us off somewhere that we didn't know. I was the foolish one. I didn't understand the language, and that I had made a false assumption about this guy who turned out to be, even though he had a little temper problem, he was lovely. He helped us out. And the G was for what was good about it, was I discovered that always the best things happen when everything falls apart. There's always something to be learned in those detour moments. And I made a friend in disguise. The L for looking glass is, I was the despicable one for making a snap judgment just based on the way somebody looked. I was the one who was prejudiced. I made a judgment that this was a bad guy just because of the dark circles under his eyes and the hunched back and the strange look on the face. The E for elevate was that I realized I need to remember that everyone, there are rare exceptions. Of course, there are exceptions. There are some people that are not great people on this planet, but 99.9% of them, Malcolm Gladwell's book did research, Talking to Strangers is the name of his book, about how most people we meet are good people, despite what they look like, despite their different religion or different way of being, if we give them a chance. And I realized, I looked up the word fati, and it means fate. And there's a saying that goes back to the Stoics, and it says amor fati, which is love your fate. And I realized it doesn't mean love your fat, by the way, it means love your fate. And I felt that fati was teaching me about how to embrace all the imperfections, all the things that go wrong, and to love them, because they are the things that make up our lives, and it's all worth loving. So I've never told that story out loud. Thank you, Victor. It was kind of a long one, but there you go.
The congruence of Kelly Sullivan Walden. Will be back with more after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, Kelly Sullivan Walden. We're talking about her new book, A Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste. Kelly, we're living in angry times, witnessing people expressing anger, sometimes frighteningly so, and instilling fear in those who witness it. How may we ogle these situations?
Great question, Victor. I think there's something about, depending on if we want to transform or not. I mean, for people who, it's a lot easier to blame. It's a lot easier when we are in pain about anything to look outside ourselves and to point our fingers, but we stay stuck that way. If we want to, like, there's that saying that pain is necessary, mandatory even, but suffering is optional. If we want to curtail the suffering, it's a very strange, and it seems counterintuitive to do this. But the moment we point the fingers back at ourselves and look at ourselves and ask, how is this me? How is the thing that is so upsetting to me? How is this an aspect of myself? And how can I correct that little part of myself? Or how can I uplevel that part of myself? That's when it's like we exit the matrix. We step out of pain and victimhood. And I realize my perspective is, most of the stories in my book, A Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste, I ogle them, meaning I found the gold nuggets in them after the fact, sometimes years after the fact. But my goal is to ogle in real time, to be able to transform even when something difficult is happening on the fly. I think that is the next marker of our evolution. If we can look for what's good about something, even while it's happening, while it's hot, while it's live. And so I think it's our mandate. Should we choose to accept it? I think we can, like Barbara Marx Hubbard used to talk about, the late great Barbara Marx Hubbard talked about quantum evolution, and as opposed to the incremental baby step evolution. If we really want to wake up, the name of the game is to be able to see ourselves in everyone and everything, and then we can do something about it. We are only powerful when it comes to what we can do in our own lives. We can't fix or change anybody out there, and there is no out there. It's all in the looking glass, P.S. So that's the good news. It might feel like the bad news for a moment. It might bruise our ego for a second, but ultimately, that's where the power is. We are so much more powerful than we realize.
How may we share this with our sisters and brothers and elevate one another?
Thank you so much. Well, I think we need to just be a, like they say in 12-step programs, be a program of attraction, not promotion. I think when people, when we practice our own version of ogle, however we do it, then we start to become the light that lights up the world. We start to be that beacon that people ask us, I'll have what he's having, or what are you doing? What are you putting in your Cheerios that's making you so happy and so peaceful? And yeah, and I, you know, if people want to read my book, one thing I've been hearing from people is that by hearing all these different stories and noticing all the different ways that I've practiced my ogle method on these stories, that they start to map it onto their own lives, and they start to see how they can transform what's been going on in their life. They're curtailing their suffering and transforming it quickly into empowerment. So one way to do it is by reading the book and seeing how I've screwed up in so many ways and eventually found the gold in those situations. And then maybe you can do it quicker than I. That's my hope.
Wonderful. I noticed that you say a percentage of the proceeds from the book benefit the Claire's Place Foundation. Please tell us about the work of this organization.
Oh, my heavens. Claire Wineland was a young woman who passed away. I believe she was 21, might have been 22 when she passed away of cystic fibrosis. And she's one of the stories in the book is about Claire. And she was and still is one of the most inspirational beings I ever knew. She outlived, she wasn't supposed to live more than a day. And then she ended up living 22 years, and her organization helps families who are dealing with someone with cystic fibrosis, and gives them the tools and the kind of the kits that she created for how to help. And also financially, a lot of times families that deal with cystic fibrosis, it's not only the patient that is struggling, but the families can't work and they're often having a very difficult time. So the Claire's Place Foundation helps with that. And there's a movie out called 5 Feet Apart. And it was a movie that was made about Claire. If you want to learn more about her, check out Claire Wineland. There's actually even a YouTube documentary about her called Claire. I think it's just called Claire or Clarity. But yeah, I want to give back to that organization. She taught me to never take a breath for granted. Every breath is sacred.
Absolutely. Her book, A Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste, The Art of Transforming the Tragic into Magic. Kelly Sullivan Walden, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Thank you so much, Victor, the voice Furman. It's been so wonderful to be with you. Oh God, what a miracle and what a blessing. If people want to go to my website, they can go to kellysullivanwalden.com. And if that's too hard to spell, they can go to ihadthestrangestdream.com. They can also find me on all social media. On Facebook, it's Kelly Sullivan Walden Dreams, or on TikTok and Instagram, Kelly S. Walden. And they can also find my book, A Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste, wherever books are sold. And I always suggest the local bookstores first and or their local Barnes & Noble. It's honor and support those stores, but you can buy it anywhere. Amazon is great too. So, I'm offering some wonderful giveaways on my website on Kelly Sullivan Walden. If you put your name and email address, you'll get some goodies from me.
Kelly, you are an absolute gift. Thank you for what you bring to our world.
Thank you, Victor Furman. And thank you so much for having me on your show. It means so much to me that I got to share some of these stories with you, and that despite my fear in the past, you didn't kick me off the island because of my, you know, I mean, it's very meaningful for me to get to be with you again and to be a part of your Platinum Club. I'm going to tell everybody, talk about my ego getting puffed up. I'm part of Victor Furman's. I'm part of Destination Unlimited.
Well, Kelly, you and I have a groovy kind of love. So thank you very much for joining us.
I love you.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the voice, Furman. Have a wonderful week.